Hey there, fellow travelers. Welcome to the Tolkien Road, episode 258. So Greta is off this week, but in her absence, I am joined by Michael Jahosky. I interviewed Michael back on episode 247, which you should all go check out. Michael is joining me as a guest co-host for this episode. And that's the first time that we have done something like this on the Tolkien Road, where we've had an actual guest co-host. We've had plenty of, you know, interviewees and that sort of thing, but Michael was gracious enough to join me on fairly short notice. So Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, happy to be here, John. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, happy to have you. Thanks for joining.
This is going to be fun.
Michael, before we jump in, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself and what you're up to these days.
Yeah, sure. So the best way to start is just, I have a website, www.mythicmission.com. People can learn more about my academic background and all that jazz there. I'm still kind of working on getting the word out about my book and doing podcast interviews for Mythic Mission, which is our podcast on Anchor, and just doing the daily grind. I'm teaching humanities classes at St. Petersburg College these days, and that's about all that I'm up to. So if you want to stay current, just follow me on my website.
Very cool. Yeah. So yeah. That's episode 247. We really discussed Michael's book that he held up there. So the name of that book is The Good News of the Return of the King, and you all should go check it out and get yourself a copy. So
thank you. Yeah.
On this episode, we continue our exploration of what Tolkien meant by Lord of the Rings being fundamentally religious and Catholic as we explore the connection between Middle-earth mythology and key Christian ideas. So, you know, a couple of episodes ago, with Greta and I dove into the letter that actually makes that reference and the background of that letter, who Tolkien was writing to, those sorts of things. So you need to go back to that episode. That's kind of a first parter, if you will, of this episode and or of this little mini series we're doing here on this topic. And on this one, I want to do my best to try and tie some of these things together to say where I think Tolkien was going with that idea, right? Because one of the challenges with that quotation is it seems very clear, but what exactly did he mean by that? Right. That's kind of the perennial question with this. And it's a controversial question in Tolkien fandom as well. So we're going to talk, I'm going to introduce you guys to some references, which I think help kind of flesh that out, what Tolkien was getting at, because I think it was something he was discovering throughout his entire life. So before we get started, we'd like to give a double up air five to our patrons. Michael, you willing to join me for the double up air five here?
Absolutely.
All right. We count it down. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. Boom. All right. Special thanks to this episode's executive producers, Andrew T., John R., and Ms. Anonymous. Please support the Tolkien Road by visiting patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Also, subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes and other podcasting platforms. Give us that 5-star rating if you are a 5-star fan, and that helps us to keep on evering on. And then YouTube, it's time for the weekly Tolkien Road Air 5 for all those watching us on YouTube. So this is just one Air 5, one Air 5. All right. 3, 2, 1. Whoops. Boom. All right. Michael, thanks for joining us for that. All right.
Oh, you bet.
Head on over to YouTube. So I think we just hit 900 subscribers as I was checking this morning. So we're getting close to that 1,000 people, and we want to get that 1,000 so we can be doing some live streaming and some more fun things over there for you guys. So let's get it up there to 1,000 quickly.
Let's do it.
All right, Michael, let's talk about the topic at hand. So Tolkien claimed that Lord of the Rings was fundamentally religious and Catholic. So what? Just where does the rubber hit the road in all of this? Many of you might be saying maybe this was the case in his own mind, but I just don't see it. So in this episode, we're going to try and connect some of those dots. So first off, let's examine what Tolkien said about the nature of the mythological powers that he envisioned for Middle-earth. In his famous Waldman letter, he asserted, and I got to pull up my reference here because I'm a little behind here, but let's get it here, 146. Mm-hmm. All right. In this letter to Waldman, which is letter 131, right, Michael?
Yep, that's right.
Yep. Okay. Yep. He says, the cycles begin with a cosmogonical myth, the music of the Ainur. God and the Valar, or powers, English as gods, are revealed. These latter are, as we should say, angelic powers, whose function is to exercise delegated authority in their spheres of rule and government, not creation, making, or remaking. They are divine, that is, were originally outside and existed before the making of the world. Their power and wisdom is derived from their knowledge of the cosmogonical drama, which they perceived first as a drama, that is, as in a fashion we perceive a story composed by someone else, and later as a reality. On the side of mere narrative device, this is, of course, meant to provide beings of the same order of beauty, power, and majesty as the gods of higher mythology, which can yet be accepted, well, shall we say baldly, by a mind that believes in the Blessed Trinity. So as with all things Tolkien there, Michael, there's a whole lot going on in that one paragraph, yeah, which is really a pretty brief thing. There's a lot to talk about there. But the key reference that had me go back to that was acceptable to a mind that believes in the Blessed Trinity. So I don't know, Michael, I'm going to start off. I'm going to kind of put you on the spot and say, what does that mean to you? Like when Tolkien references that here, what do you think he's getting at?
Can I first just back up though, to say, I don't know that we're meant to always glimpse the Catholic vision underlying the mythology. I think that's part of the point. The hiddenness of the worldview that Peter Kreft in his Philosophy of Tolkien book, he says, it's like, you know, the molten core of the earth, it's beneath the surface. So that people don't always see it. You know, they say, oh, well, maybe it was just in his mind, but I don't see it. I think that was part of the quality that makes it so Christian, or, and specifically Catholic.
Yeah.
So that's one thing I'd say. I mean, here I'd have to reference, so to come back to the letter, acceptable to a mind that understands mystery is what I think he's getting at, number one. But number two, the work of John H. Walton, biblical scholar, Old Testament scholar, and Dr. Mike Heiser, who right now prayer is appreciated. He's fighting cancer. I think he's doing okay. But both of them have expanded this, and I do so in my book as well, to understand that, you know, in the Bible, we might be able to make a case that the, you know, references, especially I think it's Psalm 88, if I'm not mistaken, or Psalm 82, I have to go find it, but the Divine Council Psalm, there's actually several passages throughout the Old Testament that talk about a plurality of gods. And of course, we know that Judaism and Christianity are monotheistic, but then we have the Trinity, and this trips up a lot of people. So one of the things that Heiser and Walton point out is that God's, you know, unity is not violated by putting forward the argument that, you know, the ancient Jews, for example, had an idea that God was surrounded by a council. And in many ways, I think that's what Tolkien may be drawing on, is that he understood that Old Testament language, that God has a council, and the Valar and the Maiar, or the Ainur in general, are parts or members of that divine council. And then, of course, later with Christian revelation to come to the Trinity, you know, what was something that I think ancient Jews didn't quite understand, they were anticipating the revelation of the triune God. And so, okay, well, if you can understand this idea of God in relation to sub or junior divine beings upon whom, you know, they have their contingent upon God, right? They're not equal to him. Then you can understand something like the Trinity, which has behind it this idea of, well, many, but not many, but one. And so I think we have to look into Old Testament theology here to get a fully orbed response.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. And it kind of leads into where my mind was going with this too, right? One of the things that we covered many months ago was this question of, is Lord of the Rings and by extension all of Middle Earth pagan, right? Is it this pagan sort of created universe, right? Subcreated universe. And it's a pretty fascinating question, because there's actually a lot of pagans who, like modern pagans, who want to claim Tolkien as one of their own, right? Or claim Middle Earth as their own, right? Because it's like, well, look, they, you know, you have the elves singing these hymns to this goddess, and, you know, and you have all these gods who are in charge of the world. And I think we have to we have to really seek to understand what Tolkien was getting at here, because he qualifies all of what he says in this paragraph by saying that I wrote this as something to be acceptable to a mind that believes in the Blessed Trinity, right? Exactly. So as not to violate what I hold sacred as a Catholic, right? As a Christian, this belief in the Blessed Trinity and one divine essence, mm-hmm. and three persons, right? And so it's not, you know, it's to be one God, right? So as That's to be right. one God, right? Mm-hmm. And that, like you said, is a big mystery, you know, mm-hmm. And it's one that Christians still grapple with as they seek to better understand the God they worship. But I think that Tolkien was also trying to make a case that we don't have to be completely like throw out this idea that there are other supernatural beings in play, right? The idea seems to be that you have God, who is the ground of all being, the one who is, right? Which mm-hmm. which would be an acceptable thing to say about God for both Jews, Christians, and other monotheists, right? Mm-hmm. But then you also have this idea of like subcreated powerful beings who are, in terms of their power, their existence, they go beyond what we as human beings exist as.
That's right.
And there's limitations on our relationships with them as human beings, right? But mm-hmm. They're not necessarily like just, they're not outside the realm of possibility when it comes to understanding the cosmogony of Judaism, of Christianity, of any of these things, any more than they are within Tolkien's subcreated cosmogony. So go ahead.
Just real quick, I just want to tack onto that something that might be helpful. It's Psalm 82, for those of you that are interested, the Divine Council Psalm. It's kind of a real explicit sort of revelation of this idea of a divine council. Think of it this way. God has a divine family, non-human divine family, and he has a non-divine human family, right? We are his earthly family. He has also in the dimension of heaven, the transcendent part of reality, he has his heavenly family. And just like we are contingent on him for our existence and are not equal to him in any way and made in his image, his divine family also is. And you can see just this sprawling commentary that Walton and Heiser go and explain other passages like Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 8-9, when God disinherits the nations after Babel. That's a commentary on the Genesis 11 story. And this has to do with God saying, okay, fine, you don't want to worship me. You know, he said it to Adam and Eve, and we lived out our consequences. He says it to his divine family too. And mm-hmm. so there is this, in the Old Testament, this unknown, and it shouldn't be unknown. I think it's been there all along. I think people have been catching up to it. This story that does acknowledge and accept the possibility of the existence of other divine beings, but in no way is this dualism like in Zoroastrianism, where you have Ahura Mazda, the God of light and goodness. And I know it's tempting to see it that way. And then Ahriman, you know, the God of darkness, and he's equal to the God of light. Right. In no way are any of these divine beings, just like we're not, on the same footing as God. So mm-hmm. it might be helpful to frame it in those terms. And that was really helpful for me to understand the cosmology behind the Ainur. And I thought that was very helpful.
Yeah, I mean, really what it comes back to, I think, to put it in like kind of like pretty simple terms, is mm-hmm. God as Tolkien envisions the God within Middle Earth, right? Eru, mm-hmm. right? Eru Iluvatar. He envisions yep. him as the ultimate storyteller, right? The storyteller, the one who is actually telling the story. And then, so even the other Valar, the Valar, the Maiar, the Ainur, right? The most mm-hmm. powerful beings that are created, they are created and they are part of his story, right? Mm. They're part of the story that he tells, right?
Exactly.
And that's the same way that that Christians would envision the God we worship, right? That the God is the ultimate storyteller, and that no one ultimately violates, right, the story that he's telling, right? So mm-hmm. and so that becomes this interesting question of how does he then participate in the unfolding of that story, right?
Mm. He tells that to Melkor, doesn't he? In the Ainur Lendale, he tells him, you know, any plan of your own making is just going to redound into the theme of music I've created. You can't do anything apart from me. Even though the perception may be, you know, na-na-na-na, poo-poo, I can do what I want, that's not going to happen.
Doesn't quite work that way, right? Yeah, because it's because I envision everything, and I'm it kind of worked that into my plan, right?
So exactly,
yeah, and so it can be interesting, because then as we're hearing the story unfold, the one, right? Eru we'll refer to the one in general as in Middle Earth terms, Eru Iluvatar. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Seems to participate in the story in various ways, like in mysterious ways, right?
Yeah.
And so you're tempted to think of him as merely a participant in the story, ultimately, and that's a lot of what we see, I feel like, in the Old Testament as well, right? So
sure.
Old Testament terms, we see the God of the Jews participating in the story and what would seem like as a powerful being, but as a, you know, as just another participant in the story, right? Mm-hmm. When in reality, what we're seeing there is kind of this pulling back of the curtain and him peeking through and saying like, and so you get the sense of like, what if any story you're in, right? Like the person writing that story, like peeked through and said,
sure,
here I am. And this is what I think about right now. Right.
Well,
this is
and
I'm thinking about.
That's exactly right, John. And I know this is anticipating something on the outline later, but you know, in the debate of Finrod and Andreth, that's exactly what Tolkien says, is that he must remain. I mean, obviously I think it's Finrod saying it, but he must remain the author within, but also the author without. Mm-hmm. And he explains it to Andreth, who's, you know, kind of skeptical about it, that, you know, he can enter it like a painter enters his picture or an author his or her story, you know. Yes. And it's brilliant. Just those terms that are used, it's pretty clear Tolkien's alluding to the Christian God there.
Yeah. And so I think to kind of put a bow on this particular section of our discussion of that particular passage, here's where I'm kind of going with this. And I see what Tolkien, like what he kind of was discovering as his life project with this Middle Earth thing. I feel like he had this passion from a young age for the stories of paganism, right? For like kind of the ancient mythologies, right? Something he shared with C.S. Lewis. And I think probably for a lot of people who, you know, in English terms, who wound up as academics in that era, they were raised in sort of that, with that sort of classical education where they were exposed to all of these ancient mythologies. Tolkien, obviously, through his love of language, discovered other mythologies that many others wouldn't have gotten into, Northern European mythologies. And it on one hand, he's sitting there thinking like, well, I can't really like adopt these as my own because I'm a Christian and I don't believe them, right? But I still love them, right? And I feel like there's a lot of truth in them, right? Mm-hmm. And so it was almost like he was discovering that his life project was the absorption of these ancient mythological styles into the mythology of Christianity. And I don't use mythology, speaking of, as a Christian believer, I don't say mythology of Christianity in a pejorative sense, right? Of like that it's a mythology, right? Is it not true? I use that in a sense of like the scheme, if you will, right? The whole like understanding of it, right? And the story that it tells.
Exactly.
And by the way, like for those who are not familiar with that concept, you know, it's like Christians, many times they think of Christianity more in terms of a story than in terms of a religion of like rules and rituals, right? So it's always something that's important to remember as part of that background. But so it's not a burial of the past, but a recovery, as Tolkien would say, right? That's a key thing from On Fairy Stories, seeing things as they were meant to be seen. When he says the way they were meant to be seen, this of course has to do with seeing all things through the lens of the Christian story, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of that overlight, that the light of Christ sheds light on all things, right? Mm-hmm. And brings everything into a proper understanding and a proper relationship. In a way, Tolkien's life was a life work was about reappropriation, taking things that have been cast away as worthless artifacts by modernity and shining new light upon them so that they may be seen in their true beauty and glory. That's what he did with Beowulf in a very famous essay, right? And kind of reopened. I got to take off my coat here, getting a little hot in here. I'm getting going, you know.
We're warming up.
That's right. So, you know, he, with Beowulf, he kind of took this story that people were starting to treat as this like ancient artifact. Mm-hmm. And he like rediscovered it and made the case that like, this is something that is not just relevant as a historical artifact, but is relevant as something still beautiful to the human soul, right? Absolutely. And here's why. Right. And so last thing I'll say on this part is just, this is of course what Christianity has been from the beginning in terms of the Old Testament, right? In terms of seeing itself as a continuity, and continuity with Judaism, right? Not consciously Christian, but seen as such through the lens of the New Testament, right? So in terms of the Old Testament, right? The Old Testament, you know, doesn't use the name Jesus anywhere, but like Middle Earth, maybe, right? In terms of being fundamentally Christian, like Christians look back at the Old Testament and say, there's Jesus, you know, in all these different places, right?
That's right.
And then also in terms of ancient pagan culture, Christ is the logos, the beginning and end of all things. We see that in John's gospel at the very beginning, when he tries to make this case of Christ being this logos, right?
Yeah.
This thing that would have been relevant, especially to the Greek culture of the time. So anyway, I just talked for a really long time. So before I jump to the next thing, Michael, you got any thoughts you want to share?
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few, but I just have to give a shout out. There's a really excellent book that was just released by J. Warner Wallace called Person of Interest. And I read a lot. If you look at my bibliography and my book, you can tell. This book has two of the finest chapters addressing the relationship between non-Christian myths and the Christian myth that I've ever read. And for example, he says there are 15 indicators that you can look at in Mithraism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, look at all of them, that and Christianity, and that the only worldview that really has, the only story that has all 15 of these is Christianity, even though many of the others share them. And he gives this really powerful explanation too, when you were talking about the Old and the New Testament, about, you know, Jesus isn't mentioned, but, you know, he compares it, as a cold case detective, which he is, between clear and cloaked evidence. You know, sometimes there are very clear prophetic texts in the Old Testament looking forward to Jesus. And other times we need to do, as I say in my book too, a retrospective look from the risen Jesus on the Emmaus Road and look back to see the cloaked evidence, some of the passages that were clearly, you never thought were about Jesus, but were all along. And so it's really fine stuff. And, you know, I just say in closing that if Christianity is the true myth, if it's the completely true story of the world, we would expect to see similarities between non-Christian stories and the Christian story. If God was really trying to pave the way for himself and his ultimate incarnation, then that's exactly what C.S. Lewis says in many of his essays. What we should expect is that it's not the difference between truth and falsity, says, but between a real historical event on the one hand and dim dreams and premonitions of that same event on the other. And he's referring there to the pagan myths, you know? So I think that's powerful stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thought that crossed my mind as you were speaking about, I think that it could be easy for, you know, people to be off put by this subject when they love Tolkien and they, you know, they come to it and they're maybe they have a, you know, a pre-existing problems with Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. And they come to this subject and for whatever reason, and they come to this subject and they're like, oh, here we go talking about this again. Can we just talk about Middle Earth? And
sure.
I think what we need to, like, what I want to encourage people to understand is that there are, you know, different minds when it comes to, you know, Christianity. And it's like, there's a mind that comes to it and says, and I think this is where we'd both classify ourselves. Yes, we believe that Jesus, we believe what Jesus said when he said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, right? No one goes to the Father except through me. But I think what the work that Tolkien was undertaking there was to not look at the past, to not look at the things that were these dim dreams of the past in these pagan cultures, these pre-Christian cultures, and say, it's all a bunch of rubbish, right?
Right.
He was looking back at those things and saying, like, look at the things that people were uncovering, these intuitive notes in the human soul and the ways they were trying to find this greater meaning, right?
Yes.
In the universe, right? And exactly. Yes, that could have, you know, it resulted, as it will in all human cultures, in abuses in some cases, but it also resulted in many beautiful things that is Tolkien. And that's what Tolkien basically said in Beowulf. It's like, do we just toss this great poem because it's not perfectly Christian, or absolutely. I mean, really in his terms, it was not perfectly modern. We just toss this great poem onto the, you know, rubbish heap of history, you know, consign it to, you know, the everlasting flames. Or do we like look back and say, like, wow, this is really beautiful stuff. And we see this longing for the Christ in these things, right? In all of these
absolutely.
Things.
Absolutely. Beautifully said. Yeah. And I think just one last thing to piggyback on what you said, people who come to Christian interpretations of the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's, you know, legendarium and have concerns about Christianity, or people who have both, you know, what we're trying to, I think, say is there's a reconciliation between, you know, the other myths that you love and the Christian myth. And it may be that people sometimes fear having these kinds of conversations because they misunderstand Christianity, is that they've been brought up with a caricature of Christianity that's hateful towards other religions and dismissive towards other myths. And that's not at all what we're saying. And I don't think that's what Tolkien was saying either. And so I think that's important that people hear that. When we say it's a Christian interpretation, I had one commentator on my book say, it's like you're claiming it for yourself. I'm like, no, it's the world story. It belongs to everybody now. Mm-hmm. And in this way, if God is really the creator of all of his imagers and people in different countries who told all these different stories, and he's saying, all of you, and he says something like this toward the end of On Fairy Stories, all tales may come true. Mm-hmm. That's what he's meaning. And so I think that's very affirmational. So for people who might be concerned, that may be a further balm for your concerns. I don't know.
I hope so. And I just hope it like maybe opens the door a little, because again, the thing that we share in common is the love of Tolkien. The thing that all of us share in common is the love of Tolkien and the love of exactly. Middle Earth. And to me, that's why it's worth doing this, like covering this topic and trying to get at this, because if Tolkien said it's fundamentally religious and Catholic, he had a reason for saying that, right?
Exactly.
That's a pretty strong claim. So, all right, well, I'm gonna jump to the next thing in the outline we're sharing here, Michael. So overlapping salvation histories and On Fairy Stories. So, and this is pretty continuous to what we've been discussing, but mm-hmm. one of the favorite things that I often refer to, although I haven't read this passage in a while, but at the end of On Fairy Stories in the epilogue, Tolkien says some things that I think are pretty illuminating to helping us understand what he meant, right? So he says, mm-hmm. the Gospels contain a fairy story or a story of a larger kind, which embraces all the essence of fairy stories. They contain many marvels, peculiarly artistic, mm-hmm. great word there, beautiful and moving, mythical in their perfect self-contained significance. And among the marvels is the greatest and most complete conceivable eucatastrophe. Mm-hmm. But this story has entered history, capital H history, in the primary world. The desire and aspiration of subcreation has been raised to the fulfillment of creation. The birth of Christ is the eucatastrophe of man's history. The resurrection is the eucatastrophe of the story of the incarnation. This story begins and ends in joy. It has preeminently the inner consistency of reality. There is no tale ever told that men would rather find was true, and none which so many skeptical men have accepted as true on its own merits. For the art of it has the supremely convincing tone of primary art, that is, of creation. To reject it leads either to sadness or to wrath. That's a pretty astounding, that last sentence is a pretty, astounding and bold claim, right?
Very much so.
So, but it's such a, I think this gets to that heart of the whole concept of the storyteller, right? That, mm-hmm. that there is a storyteller outside of our reality, right? And then what Christianity says is that that storyteller, yes, exists outside of our reality and tell us the story that we're living in, but then he enters into that story,
right?
He enters into it. And that is the, as Tolkien says, the great eucatastrophe of human history when he enters into that story.
Exactly.
And so can I put you on the spot? And because sure. I can do it, but I wanted to put you on the spot and say, can you kind of explain to our readers maybe what eucatastrophe means? Because I've explained it many times, but I'm interested to hear your take on it.
Yeah, obviously the linguistic origins is the prefix EU, which is the Greek, means, good. We think of the Eucharist, and even I think the word for prayer in Greek. But if I understand it correctly, it refers to a climactic moment in a story. And of course, here Tolkien's referring to history. And you mm-hmm. might also refer to any story like The Lord of the Rings, the Bible, that gives us a sudden turn. And I like to think of it as like a glimpse of transcendence and something that snatching victory from the jaws of what would seem like obliteration. Mm-hmm. And so a sudden turn, a twist, a moment of shock and surprise, it might be. So when I was doing research for my book and talking about allegory and parable, one author, when describing Jesus's parables, and even Father Robert Murray, who wrote an essay about Tolkien and the art of the parable, says this, it's kind of like this surprise, this shock, this moment of shock that comes in a story that you don't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And it totally changes the tone. It's a paradigm shift. I think it's another word, a great word for this would be reversal of fortune. And so all of these ways is how I would start to talk about eucatastrophe.
Yeah.
There's more, of course.
No, that's a great take on it for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's just this idea of, and we see Tolkien use this many times in his stories, right? It's the moment when you think like, oh, how the heck are they going to get out of this? Right. You know, it's like that they're done for, they're toast. Right.
Yep.
And something completely unexpected, but happens. But then after you see it happen, you're like, Of course that was going to happen.
Inevitable.
It was inevitable, right? That's not in the sense of being predictable, but in the sense of like, of like, oh yeah, you know, of course. And like a lot of times that's the best storytelling. That's the storytelling that most appeals to us as human beings, it seems, right? Mm-hmm. But what that means is, if he calls the incarnation the eucatastrophe of human history, is of course that we live within a story, right? That all of us are mm-hmm. part of this story. And it's a story that's a dramatic story. That's a story of struggle. That's a story with, that's a story that involves a struggle between good and evil, right? That, mm-hmm. that involves beauty, goodness, truth, all those things that he marks out within, you know, within that quote, artistic, mm-hmm. beautiful, moving, even mythical, right? You know, yeah. that we're living in this, you know, sort of mythical story. Mm-hmm. In many ways, the time we're living in right now, you know, feels like it. And I think that honestly, any human being could say that about the time they live in, right? Oh, that, certainly. You know, there's marks of being in that story. Mm-hmm. So I guess where I'm going with that is, we see, so one of the things that we know is that Tolkien wanted to, part of what he was doing with Middle Earth was creating this constructed mythology of England, and mm-hmm. but with roots in Northern European mythologies. And so if we go back to that idea of trying to draw the ancient mythologies into the mythology of Christianity, right, then mm-hmm. here he is creating his own English mythology, and then he's saying, and now I want to draw this into the mythology of Christianity. Mm-hmm. And it was not a, you know, as he says, maybe unconsciously at first, right? Because yeah. why unconsciously? Because that's who he was,
right?
That was the thing that was most beautiful to him, mm-hmm. right? As a Christian believer, right? That story was the most beautiful story to him.
And I would make a case, and coming back to one of the things, John, that I said at the beginning about, you know, why we sometimes don't detect the Christian worldview and the Catholicism of the Lord of the Rings is, because Tolkien, according to his friend, Father Robert Murray, who wrote in 1992 and delivered this great sermon, Tolkien and the Art of the Parable, became an essay. You can find it in Tolkien, the Celebration, edited by Joseph Pierce. And he says, you know, that this is something we would expect from the master. Jesus, when he told his parables, parables are a form of indirect communication. All myths are. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, who, I mean, the incarnation is the greatest example of indirect communication. Nobody expected God to become man in the way that he did at the time that he did. And by the way, that new book I told you about by Wallace too, he examines all the different strands of things that were just so and just precisely right for the time that Jesus came. And it's really remarkable. And you're like, I never thought about roads. I never thought about this. I never thought about that. But Jesus came at the, what was it in, Galatians, right? I think mm-hmm. chapter 4, at the right time, in the fullness of time.
Yes.
And it's this amazing thing. So we think about the incarnation itself as God's ultimate indirect communication. And then the incarnation himself came speaking in indirect communication, because how else are you going to talk about, what are you going to say? Hi, I'm God. you know, they'll be like, great, let's have lunch. You know,
Well, a lot of times people will read the Gospels and they'll say, like, why doesn't Jesus like claim to be God, right? You know, and
there's
these
a good
parts.
Explanation.
And mm-hmm. there is a really good explanation, and it may not be the right time to get into it on this sure. podcast, but it struck me, like, with some of the things you're saying, and sorry, I know I kind of cut you off in mid thought, well, I hope you'll come back to whatever it was you were going to say, but I was just going to say, it's like the ultimate that Jesus was born in, like, you know, in this like backwater. In terms of that time, the Roman Empire, it was like the most backwater place you could be born into. And in a backwater situation, mm-hmm. it was like the ultimate, by the way, right? You know, it was like the Shire, you know, of that time.
Yeah, exactly.
Although maybe a much more dysfunctional Shire.
Yeah, a little drier too.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah.
That's funny. No, I was done. I mean, I was just, I'm marveling at the sense of timing and of course, just this indirect art that it was important for Tolkien, I think, who loved Jesus so much and modeled his communication on the way that the master himself spoke to people. Mm-hmm. It was so part of him that it was unconscious. How could it not be? I mean, for somebody who really loves Jesus and loves the church and loves God's people, and all people are God's people, if you're really that person that's so immersed in it, you know, Bible passages spring to mind, you have this deep love and affection for Jesus, then I think knowledge of Jesus, intimate knowledge of Jesus, leads to that kind of way of communicating. And I think that might be the ultimate explanation as to why he, I don't want to say consciously unconscious, but it was just so part of him, and it just came out of him so naturally.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think the insight there is that, and we all know this intuitively as Tolkien lovers, and is marveling at how his stories have affected so many people, even beyond like just the people who are like complete nerds about him. Right. But the way that the stories get into your soul. And I think that's something of what you're getting at with this, like it indirect communication makes it sound weak, but it actually has a way of getting much deeper into who we are as human beings, right? These stories.
Absolutely.
And that's actually true of like the ancient mythologies as well, right? Those things got, like, we still talk about these stories, which are like completely fantastical to us, you know,
absolutely.
Like we still talk about them today and we still educate our kids about them today. Right.
Yep.
You know, and I think if we choose not to, we do actually do them a disservice, right? Which is an interesting thought in and all of itself. But
it
so let's kind of tie this one together and say, okay, so the incarnation is the eucatastrophe of man's history. Tolkien is drawing these ancient mythologies into the story of Christianity, which he says is the story of mankind. And then how does that play itself out? So I think there's a lot we could say about this, but a couple of key things that I think I want to draw out here. Two of them come from History of Middle Earth, Volume 10, with the chapter on the Othrabeth, right? So the dialogue between Finrod and Andreth. So the first actually is later on in the chapter, and it's an account of that Tolkien was working on later in life. And again, this is written well after he wrote Lord of the Rings, right? So he had written Lord of the Rings. He had kind of gone through this process of discovering that, whoa, yeah, there's a lot of my Catholic faith here. And my contention is that he spent the rest of his life trying to get the Silmarillion in order, but also trying to like get the whole cosmogony in order and the whole story in order, because he sensed like he started to discover what he was trying to do. Right.
I agree. Yeah.
And so,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
No, just real quick. I think the debate text, especially, which was, you know, late 1950s, we think it's when he wrote it after 55 sometime. I think 58 is posited date, but he is meditating on his mythology. He's looking back on it retrospectively and saying, yeah, I didn't realize how much of Christ was in this. And by saying that too, the implication carries with it is other religious truths and insights as well, that from Northern, European mythology and others, that Christ was just kind of there and bringing all the fragments together. And I think he did spend the rest of his life trying to make it all consonant, you know, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
So totally agree.
Yeah. So the first thing I'm going to read from here is, it's just a couple of short passages from a much longer passage. And this is on, this is actually pretty late in the chapter, and it's not part of the main section of the Othrabeth, but it's from the Tale of Adonel. And so there's a couple of key passages here, but just to preface this is a tale that Andreth, who is the human woman, right, the human female, right, in the story, who is having a dialogue with Finrod, who of course is in this elvish person. So it's a mortal and an immortal and a mortal having this dialogue about the meaning of life, basically. Like what, right. Like what, why are we here? Right. and then Andreth relates this tale that was told to her by Adonel of the House of Hador about basically the fall of man. Right. And so it's a really fascinating thing to check out, just to, if you want to know Tolkien's kind of Middle Earth take on the fall of man. But basically a couple of key passages. The first is the voice, and this is capitalized V, right? So this voice, we can pretty well, it's clear that it's Eru, right? It's Eru Iluvatar speaking to the first men in Middle Earth. The voice said, "Ye are my children. I have sent you to dwell here. In time, you will inherit all this earth. But first you must be children and learn. Call on me and I shall hear, for I am watching over you." So Eru's first word, and it's kind of a, you know, it first word to the first people and the first men, the first mortals in Middle Earth is, "You are my children. I have sent you to dwell here. In time, this will all be yours, right? But I want you to learn, right? I want you to discover, right?" And he makes it clear that he has them there to discover, right? To learn, to grow up, to mature, right? Mm-hmm. So that is Eru's original intention for men. Okay. And then just to kind of take the story forward, Melkor, and we don't know he's Melkor, but we can intuit he's Melkor from the story. Melkor mm-hmm. comes among them a little later and deceives them into serving and worshiping him, and that the other voice wishes to keep goodness from them, right? So mm-hmm. so that Eru is actually not good. He's not benevolent. He actually intends them harm, right? And wants to keep all good things from them. And then they learn, they basically decide they're going to trust the voice of Melkor, right? He deceives them. He comes as an angel of light, basically. He comes as this being of beauty. And, you know, classic devil, right?
Absolutely.
Classic devil, right? So yep. He comes as this angel of light, you know, tickling their ears, telling them all the things they want to hear. And then over time, they trust him. And then he starts to dominate them, right? Mm-hmm. And from there on, men are subject to the shadow, death, slavery, shortness of life. They have little light in this life. And then Eru comes to them later after all this has transpired and essentially says to them, I'm going to read from this, the first voice we never heard again, save once. In the stillness of the night, it spoke, saying, you have abjured me, but you remain mine. I gave you life. Now it shall be shortened, and each of you in a little while shall come to me to learn who is your Lord, the one you worship or I who made him, right? So this is one I can't wait to actually get to and talk about the whole thing because I think it'll be fascinating. But we understand there that, I guess all I want to say is that Tolkien like actually mapped out the fall of man in Middle Earth, right? And it's something that sounds an awful lot like the fall of man in Genesis. Right? Mm. I mean, just in terms of like the mythological structure of it, right?
Sure.
Would you agree with that?
Oh, I totally would. I'm starting to just make all sorts of connections here. This is not something I had time or space in my book to get into. I really focused on the debate, but I wonder, you know, why I didn't justify it, because this is great stuff. It got me thinking too about the Eden story and the debates that Christians have sometimes about, was there pain and suffering and potentiality for death prior to the fall? It's just that because we had access to the tree of life that, you know, it didn't occur. We were in the presence of the Lord. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, just making connections. It's such a beautiful, beautifully written passage too, isn't it?
Yes. And that's the genius of Tolkien, is he could do these dialogues and it ends up being so beautiful. I mean, the way the author Beth itself ends, you're like fighting back tears, right?
Yeah.
Because of the way it's not just this like disembodied dialogue between these two figures. It's like you come to love them through this dialogue and then you identify with them, right? You identify with them in the pain, especially that, that Andreth is in, right?
Well, yeah. And the lament over the bitterness and skepticism toward the idea of Eru coming into his creation, but also the fact that this death feels like a punishment to them and that the elves have it better. And Finrod constantly has to point out, you know, no, I think you misunderstand, you know, or don't envy us. It's more complicated than that. And I think what makes it so powerful, John, is that it is incarnated in a dialogue. It's not an abstract text, you know, where Tolkien could have written like a theological tract, but he didn't.
Right.
It's so personal. And so, yeah, I agree with you.
Well, I wasn't going to bring this particular point up, but you talked about this some of these questions that they're theological questions, maybe metaphysical questions about, you know, what was God's like intention for mankind prior to the fall, right? And that's a question that theologians, you know, Christian theologians wrestle with, right? You know, what were we supposed to live forever here? Like, what was the idea? I have been convinced after becoming Catholic many years ago, and I've really felt like as I've thought about it more and more through Catholic theology, that God's intention for us was to grow up here and then to fall asleep, like in a peaceful way, like to basically fall asleep in the same way that Catholics and Orthodox believe in like Mary's dormition, right? So she is being a sinless mortal, right? She falls asleep in perfect peace, right? Mm-hmm. And not only her soul, but her body is taken away from earth, right?
Mm-hmm. Assumption, yeah.
Yeah, and we see like, we see notes of that in different places in the Old Testament, of course, of people being assumed into heaven. And it actually, he discusses that in here. So Tolkien brings that idea up. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm gonna be able to get, I don't have the reference for you because I know you don't have a copy of this right in front of you.
Yeah. Sorry.
But, I'm gonna try and do a good job of summarizing this. Okay. Then basing his argument. So this is Tolkien speaking about what, like some other notes on what, where he wanted to go with some things, right? He says, mm-hmm. then basing his argument on the axiom that severance of, Hroa and Fea, which are the body and soul, is unnatural and contrary to design. He comes, or if you like, jumps to the conclusion that the Fea of unfallen man would have taken with it its Hroa into the new mode of existence, free from time. Mm-hmm. In other words, that assumption, he uses that word specifically, was the natural mm-hmm. end of each human life, though as far as we know, it has been the end of the only unfallen member of mankind. And that's Tolkien referencing Mary there. So mm-hmm. he actually deals with that question, right?
You know,
so this is why this is such an incredible
part of the reason why
it's such an incredible dialogue.
Yes. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. So, one other thing I wanted to draw out from the Athrobeth for this episode is on the incarnation. So mm-hmm. Tolkien deals with this as well through this dialogue. And so I'm going to read this passage here. Finrod, however, and again, this is actually Tolkien's notes. This is like a commentary on the Athrobeth. And again, like, Tolkien made all these notes, he wanted to expand them. So this is from one of the notes. Finrod, however, sees now that as things were, no created thing or being in Arda or in all Ea was powerful enough to counteract or heal evil. That is, to subdue Melkor in his present person, reduced though that was, and the evil that he had dissipated and sent out from himself into the very structure of the world. Mm-hmm. Only Eru himself could do this. Therefore, since it was unthinkable that Eru would abandon the world to the ultimate triumph and domination of Melkor, which could mean its ruin and reduction to chaos, Eru himself must at some time come to oppose Melkor. But Eru could not enter wholly into the world and its history, which is, however great, only a finite drama. He must, as author, always remain outside the drama, even though that drama depends on his design and he will for its beginning and continuance. In every detail and moment, Finrod therefore thinks that he will, when he comes, have to be both outside and inside. And so he glimpses the possibility of complexity or of distinctions in the nature of Eru, which nonetheless leaves him the one. Since Finrod had already guessed that the redemptive function was originally specially assigned to men, he probably proceeded to the expectation that the coming of Eru, if it took place, would be especially and primarily concerned with men. That is, to an imaginative guess or vision that Eru would come incarnated in human form. This, however, does not appear in the Athrobeth. So no. Tolkien was kind of working this out and had this prepared, how like Finrod basically predicts, right? Mm-hmm. Prophesies mm-hmm. the incarnation, right? On this very like intuitive sort of way. I think that's awesome, you know.
It's brilliant, yeah.
And the logic he uses too kind of does such a great job of mapping out the reasons for something that we, you know, as Christians, we accept as divine revelation, right? Mm-hmm. We accept it on faith, but Finrod here provides this really rational basis for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of maps out why it seems like it would be the thing, right? That's going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, John, I've got so much to say, but I know, you know, we don't have a whole bunch of time left, but I'd love to just say a few things if I could.
Absolutely.
There's another passage that, from the Athrobeth that, that really kind of reads like a defense of indirect communication, but also I think it's an indication of, and a commentary on this whole idea, the incarnation is something that's going to happen in Middle Earth. And I'll use this to go to my next point, but here's what Tolkien says. He says, as may a master in the telling of tales keep hidden the greatest moment until it comes in due course. I think this is Finrod talking. It may be guessed at indeed in some measure by those of us who have listened with full heart and mind, but so the teller would wish. In no wise is the surprise and wonder of his art thus diminished. For thus we share, as it were, in his authorship, but not so if all were told to us in a preface before we entered in. I think that this is also Tolkien kind of meditating about himself, you know, mm-hmm. looking back and saying, had I planned this consciously, you know, maybe I would have put it in a preface, or, you know, from the start would have said, this is how I'm going to make my work Christian. So there's so many different things going on here, I think. And it's just like with everything with Tolkien, there's so much speculation one can do. But I found a great amount of things to think about in that passage. And I do myself, and I made this case in my book, and I think a lot of Tolkien scholars who have written about the incarnation in Middle Earth miss and don't have some of that academic background sometimes in Christian, you know, biblical history, theology, where they really just miss this idea that the incarnation is God becoming king. And N.T. Wright has done more for establishing that today than most scholars. And I see the incarnation working out in Aragorn in many ways. And the one of the most egregiously, I think, wrong readings is to say, well, he dies. Tolkien seems to imply he's going to come back, first of all, in the appendices. But second, you know, there's this idea that, well, the fourth age happens and things go back to being bad. So how can the incarnation have come? Because it's such a dull, sad, broken world still. I said, well, Jesus came and the world is still got brokenness and sadness. And so the fourth age I see as kind of a commentary on our own life. We're living in between the moment of the incarnation and the second coming. And we should expect the world to still be fallen. You know, God isn't finished with it yet. So a lot of big ideas here. I know.
Yeah. I mean, it's well, this is what always happens when you deal with, Tolkien. Too much to say in one episode. So kind of want to wrap up everything we've talked about with some final thoughts here. So we've done we've talked a lot on previous episodes about the significance of the date, March 25th, which is of course the date of the destruction of the One Ring. And that actually is the same date as that's kind of the historical date for the Annunciation and perhaps even the crucifixion, right? So both of the events that Tolkien calls the most important events in human history. So there's no way we know it's not a coincidence that he chose that date as the date for the destruction of the One Ring. So, but what does that mean, right? So it's a nice little maybe symbolism or something, but like, what do we take away from that? And I think after doing the research for this episode and kind of thinking a lot about where was Tolkien going with all of this, I think this episode is like about defeating evil, right? It's about Tolkien's guide to defeating evil. And, and we think of like defeating evil is like the ride of the Rohirrim, right? It's like, you know, going in and with like, you know, or whatever, going in with guns blazing and all that stuff is beautiful and it's glorious and it inspires us, right? But the truth is that all that swords and guns and all of those things can ever really do is restrain evil, right? Mm-hmm. All they can really do is restrain evil ultimately, right? They can't ultimately defeat it, okay? And that is the thing that that I think Tolkien is getting at with this idea of the long defeat, right? Mm-hmm. And I think too, we think of the long defeat and it sounds like kind of a pessimistic thing, but there's actually, when you go through that veil of pessimism, you emerge on the other side and you realize, wait a minute, the long defeat is about the long defeat of evil, right?
Exactly.
And it's the long road that we have to take to defeat it, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the defeat that happens in here. And who ultimately defeats evil in the story? It's Frodo and Sam, right? Mm-hmm. It's Frodo and Sam through the long journey, right? When they look like they're going to be defeated. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that seems to be the ultimate thing that Tolkien was trying to get us all to take away from the story. Right.
Absolutely.
That it's, you know, there's a role to be played by those who restrain evil. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the sword weapons, you know, and try to uphold the good through the restraint of evil. But ultimately, that will fail by itself. Right. It can't ultimately hold the line forever. But what can defeat evil is the path that Christ marks out, right? That Christ marks out of self-surrender, self-defeat, right? Or a self-surrender of laying down one's life in love for the sake of others, right? Mm-hmm. And trusting in the providence of God, right? Trusting in the providence of God to provide and all those things. Does that make sense to you?
Oh, absolutely. I think first, I mean, I agree with everything you said. The long defeat is the defeat of evil. I think of 1 Corinthians 15, and you know, Christ putting all things under his feet, and the last enemy to be defeated is death. And I think Tolkien might have been drawing on that. And this is exactly what I was saying just a few minutes ago about the fourth age. I mean, there's so much I could say here. I lost the other thing I was going to say, but I think, oh, here it is. From Hebrews, you kind of just touched on the threefold office of Christ from the New Testament. And so you have Frodo, you have Gandalf, you have Aragorn. This has been pointed out by many Tolkien scholars that together it's an image of Christ, the incarnation defeating evil in his threefold office, you know, and it's brilliant. I think Tolkien really just made it all tie mm-hmm. together. And I love what you said about the numbers. I mean, I think the dates were so important as a Catholic. There's a special day all year round, you know, everything, the whole creation is a celebration of, I'm sorry, the calendar is something to celebrate, you know, in Catholicism. Yes. Mm-hmm. Every day is sacred, and that's how we should view creation, as sacramental. And so I think that just permeates everything Tolkien wrote.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful. That's just fascinating stuff. I'm now very like excited. I suffer from this problem where I'm like, every time I get into some topic with Tolkien, I'm like, I need to spend the next 10 episodes on that. And then it's like, yeah, it's just not enough time in the world.
I know.
Patreon.com/Tolkien Road. Just saying.
Mm-hmm. Just saying.
All right. So, Michael, thank you. This has been like our interview we did several months ago. This has just been awesome. I've really enjoyed discussing this topic with you, and definitely will be having you back as a guest host if you're willing to come back. So
I am honored, and the pleasure was mine, John. Thank you again.
Fantastic. Well, we'd love to hear from everybody. TolkienRoadPodcast@gmail.com, TolkienRoad.com, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Instagram, wherever you can find us. We'll do our best to respond to you as we can. So that's all for this episode. Thank you to our amazing patrons, especially Andrew T., John R., Ms. Anonymous, Caitlin of Tea with Tolkien, Shannon S., Brian O., Emilio P., Zeke F., James A., James L., Chris L., Chuck F., Asya V., Ish of the Hammer, Teresa C., David of Pints with Jack, Jonathan D., Eric S., Joey S., Eric B., Johanna T., Mike M., Robert H., Paul D., Julia, and Werty, as well as those celebrating their Patreon anniversary in September, Johanna T., Dustin Q., and Robert S. All right, everybody. Michael, once again, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening, everybody. We will talk at you next time. Bye-bye.